Hello and welcome. We're going to spend some time today talking about ethical dilemmas, which we all have on a regular basis. One of the things I know about an ethical dilemma is it gets to our gut before it gets to our head. We often know that we have a dilemma when our stomach hurts, not when our head tells us, oh, this doesn't feel right. One of the things I hope you take with you today is knowing how to get it from your gut to your head, because that's when we really make good decisions, is when we have reasoned it out in an intellectual way. Before we start talking about actual tools, let's do a little bit of a review. We do what we do based on our values. Values don't come to us from a profession. Values come to us from growing up. We add them to the profession. We come into professions that we're in because we have a certain set of values. What are values? Values are preferences. They're a matter of individual or group taste. They're religiously, ideologically, politically, culturally, or professionally reinforced. I often ask my students and my young supervisees what religion they grew up in. Not necessarily what religion they are now, but what religion they grew up in. Because these stick with us, even if we reject the organization. The values often stay in our head. We certainly know that values lead us politically into things. We're at a very interesting time politically now, with people that believe on this end and this end of the spectrum. Culturally, if we read cultural literature, we know that certain cultures have certain values that distinguish them. And values are professionally reinforced. We are what we are because of the values that we grew up with. Intensity of our values varies and changes over time and in response to experience. Think back on your own professional life. If you've been doing it as long as I have, you know that you started out sometimes with very rigid boundaries because you were so afraid you were going to do something wrong. But as you grew in the profession, you learned that that rigidity didn't always work for you. We know that tolerance for difference varies as far as values goes. For some people, the rigidity says you think like I think or you don't think correctly. My 96-year-old mother has a thing about paper towels. They are supposed to be white. It is not a matter of good or bad. It's a matter of right or wrong. If I don't buy white paper towels, she has somehow failed as a mother. I'm sure there's something very analytic about that, but that's not what we're talking about today. Differences, deviations, or dissent in values can lead to bias and prejudice that can lead to assault and discrimination against those who differ. We all know all too well that hate crimes happen when you see someone who you don't think carries the values that they're supposed to, and you have some divine almost mission to do something about that. If we look at a professional, values are the root and the trunk of the trees from which other things grow. If we go from the notion of values to the notion of ethics, values are belief systems. Ethics are behaviors. Ethics are preferences that affect behavior in human relationships. If we were stuck on a desert island all by ourselves, we wouldn't have a great need for ethics unless we felt certain that chopping down a palm tree was not an okay thing to do. But ethics we talk about in terms of human relationships. Ethics deal with the question of what action is right and how things ought to be. I have a little trouble with this one because I want to know who decided how things ought to be. I'm Irish by nature and question everything. Ethics clarify obligations that are owed to one person by another. What role do we have? What is the nature of a therapeutic relationship? How do we treat fellow professionals? These are dealt with through ethics. Professional ethics are codifications of special obligations that arise out of a person's choice to be a professional. We are who we are because of the ethics of our profession. And we don't want other people to tell us how we are supposed to behave. So professions come up with their own professional ethics. Some of us are working in multidisciplinary settings where we may not report to a profession that is the same as ours. Sometimes we have ethical conflicts between what we believe and what that other professional believes. Professional ethics are intended to help practitioners recognize the morally correct way of practice. Again, I have a little bit of trouble with the word morally because it implies a higher authority that has set this out for us. I want to know who set the moral standards. Now that we have a little sense of values and a little sense of ethics, let's look at ethical dilemmas. Ethical dilemmas occur when a choice must be made between two or more relevant but contradictory ethical directives. We have a wonderful example of this in Texas. Several years ago, the Texas courts held that Tarasoft would no longer be applied to the duty to warn in Texas. Professionals now are not obligated to report danger to self or others. We are told that we may, not must. People were very upset about this in the beginning. But the courts came back and said, okay, mental health professionals, you have fought for years and years and years to be able to deal with the notion of privacy and confidentiality in your work. Now you're telling us you don't want that anymore, and that doesn't make any sense to us. So, what we are now told is, if someone is homicidal or suicidal, we may contact law enforcement or we may contact medical personnel, but we cannot warn. That's caused some ethical dilemmas for some people. The NASW Code of Ethics still holds to the duty to warn. The Code of Conduct for Licensed Social Workers in Texas does not. This has caused a lot of confusion, but it has also been the thing that we now have to live with. The Texas legislature went farther to say that we can break confidentiality to protect, quote, the tiniest Texans, children, are those who are in danger that are old. We use great poetic language in Texas. This gives us the right to break confidentiality for CPS and APS referrals. But for everything else, confidentiality supersedes the duty to warn. So we've got contradictory ethical directives, and we have to make a decision. The other thing that can constitute an ethical dilemma is when every alternative results in an undesirable outcome for one or more parties. Or as the East Texas saying goes, caught between a rock and a hard place. It doesn't matter what you do. Somebody is going to be upset by it. And there is no way you can have a best outcome for both parties. People don't like this. We as social workers especially don't like this. For the rest of our time now, we're going to talk about guides for making ethical decisions. There's three large categories that we use when we make an ethical decision. One is ethical theories and principles, the other is codes of ethics, and the third is practice models. We're going to spend a good bit of time talking about each one of these. Let's look a little bit at theories of normative ethics. The first theory we're going to look at is a deontological theory that says certain actions are inherently right or wrong, good or bad, without regard for their consequences. This is the one that gives us no wiggle room. This is a very rigid way of looking at things. These are the ethical principles of absolutes. These are the thou shall not kill. These are the things that almost anybody, the principles that almost anybody would say, there's no wiggle room here. But let's look at that. Can we operate as who we are under a total deontological approach? Probably not. There's a very strong principle that says thou shalt not kill. I've worked for the VA for a very long time. If that were the case, I would not have any patients. All of my patients have been trained to kill, and it has been justified that they are doing it for a higher cause, which I happen to agree with. So can we say absolutely that this is not ever to be broken? No. The second theory is a teleological theory that says the rightness or wrongness of any action is determined by the goodness of its consequences. There's two subdivisions of this. The first is egoism, which says when faced with conflicting duties, people should maximize their own good and enhance their self-image or interest. We have some trouble with this if we look at things from a macro level. How can we take better care of one person than we do of another? They can pay us more money? Probably not. We get more standing for doing that? Probably not. What most of us use is the notion of utilitarianism, which says an act is right if it promotes the maximum good. We use this in most social justice instances where we're saying we're going to do this because more people profit from it. We get a little upset with things like some of the healthcare rationing that people talk about that says if you're too old you can't have this because other people would profit more. Or if it costs too much, it's going to deprive others of treatment. We kind of argue against that and fall back on some egoism that says a person has the right to what they need. Or at least we're going to fight for it. Let's look at four of the philosophical bases of medical ethics, because the work that most of us do is either health or mental health care, regardless of the setting that we're in. So we need to think about four philosophical bases. The first is beneficence, which is the duty to assist a person in need. That's the hallmark of what we do. Non-maleficence or non-malfeasance is the duty to refrain from causing harm to other people. Autonomy, or to a social worker, self-determination, is the moral right to choose and follow one's plan of life and action. Many of us struggle with this when we see patients going out and doing self-defeating behaviors, and we would really love for them to do it the way we think they ought to. However, they do have a right to make bad decisions. Any of us that have ever made an adult protective service referral know that one of the first questions we get is, do they have capacity to make this decision? And many young professionals still shudder at the notion of being told people have the right to make bad decisions. And it's hard sometimes for us to uphold that right to make bad decisions. But in fact, people do have that right. The last of these is the most recent of all, and it's called proportionality, that says medical treatment is ethically mandated to the extent that it is likely to confer greater benefit than burden upon the patient. We get into some trouble with this. What happens when an ethics committee decides that something is futile treatment, but we have a patient who, for individual or even religious reasons, cannot stop treatment, cannot terminate treatment? Is that really upholding proportionality? Some people think it is, some people think it's not. Loewenberg, Dolgoff, and Harrington have an ethics textbook that gives us an ethical principles screen. This screen is a guide for practitioners when they are stuck with an ethical dilemma. It gives them the right to say, okay, what principle takes precedence here? What is the hierarchy of the needs so that I can make a decision? They put first the principle of protection of life. At all cost, we protect a life. This would mean that advanced directives that said terminate treatment probably would be problematic. The second is the principle of equality and inequality. If there's a matter where we are showing inequality to someone, or someone is suffering from inequality, we need to do something about it ethically. The principle of autonomy and freedom is self-determination. We all know about that. Does self-determination outrank other things? The principle of least harm says, I am going to do what harms the person the least, even if the outcome is not a positive one. What is the lesser of two evils? The principle of quality of life is hard because quality of life is a great value judgment. The principle of privacy and confidentiality, we're back to it's almost at the bottom. But we have the right in most states to break privacy and confidentiality to protect life. The last is the principle of truthfulness and full disclosure. That means we don't trick people. And sometimes we're tempted, but that's not okay. My problem with this is it's very helpful to have these principles outlined in front of me. The problem I have is I don't agree with the order. And I wonder, as I have taught ethics different places, how many of you really do agree with this order. Most of the time, people tell me no. What I would like to do is give you just a few minutes to reorder this in a way that makes sense to you, and to give yourself time to think about why one of these may be higher on the hierarchy than others. I couldn't do that. I would have to leave the principle of protection of life first. A lot of where we put things on this screen is a result of who we are, what our personal values are. If you have been the victim of terrible inequality in your life, of prejudice, you may want equality and inequality to be at the top. If you've ever had serious issues with privacy and confidentiality, you may want to move that up. I probably would move privacy and confidentiality up a lot closer to the top than I would some of the others. But it's helpful to you to have kind of a little flowchart in your head that says, okay, when I start thinking about something, this is the way I'm going to do it. What I have found is models are very helpful to us when we are in highly emotionally charged situations. I have always taught students a model for crisis intervention, for example, because when you are there in the heat and the emotion of the moment, you need to organize yourself to be able to be helpful. This is one of those ways that we can organize ourselves. Another thing that probably is worth saying, it doesn't matter how many of you are out there, if we posed a particular ethical dilemma, we may have as many different solutions to that dilemma as we have people sitting in the room, because we all process differently. People wish that there was an easy way to do it, that we opened up a book and it said ethical dilemma one, here is the flowchart. That doesn't work. I chaired the Texas Board of Social Work Examiners for several years. And people came to us all the time when there was an ethics complaint saying, well, I wish somebody had told me you did this and this and this. But nobody can tell us that. And there is only one ethical dilemma for the profession that I can tell you unequivocally can never be done any other way. People laugh about no sex with a client. That is the only ethical dilemma that I can never hear arguments for it being any way but the way it is. Any of the others, there's wiggle room depending on who you are. Another way we look at solving ethical dilemmas, after we get through the philosophical stuff in our head, is what are our codes of ethics and what do those codes say? Philosophically, we've got it here. But then there's a code that guides our behavior. Codes are not intended as a blueprint that would remove all need for the use of judgment or ethical reasoning. If we could just pick up a code of ethics and flip through it, and there was our answer, we wouldn't need the stuff about values and ethics and philosophical principles. We would have a pat answer to everything. None of us really believe that there's a pat answer for everything. So, professions have codes of ethics. There are certain purposes of all codes. Codes identify core values and establish ethical standards for the profession. If you read the preamble to NASW's Code of Ethics, the core values of the social work profession are there, and the code establishes standards according to certain divisions of the code that handle different areas of practice. Codes also socialize practitioners to the profession. I know when I'm providing clinical supervision for young social workers who are trying to get their clinical license, one of the first things we do is we go over, first of all, the state licensing code, and then the code of ethics of whatever professional organization they belong to. It is very important to me to know that new practitioners know what the codes of ethics say and that they can define ethical terms like boundaries. This socializes them into what they're going to be doing for the rest of their professional life. It also, as an aside, protects me because if I am providing their supervision, I have legal responsibility for their practice. Codes provide guidance. Guidance is the important word here for practice dilemmas. If you're having an issue with another professional and you think, what should I do here? There's a section in the NASW code, if you happen to be a member of NASW code and abide by their code of ethics, that deals with dealing with other professionals. And it gives you an idea of, oh, it might be a good idea to talk to them about what I'm concerned about before I do anything else. Ideas, guidance, not answers. Codes of ethics protect our profession from outside control. I had said a little bit earlier that many of us, me for one, work for non-social workers. And their codes may be very different from ours. We are bound to ours. And we must be able to talk to other people who may differ from us. I don't want somebody else's code of ethics to guide what I have to do. But I have found in reporting to other professionals that I have to explain more about why I do what I do from a social work perspective. I don't want them to tell me how I have to do it. This is especially interesting if you work for the chief financial officer of your agency. They don't really understand us. I've had some interesting calls from practitioners that want ethics consults. And one was from a young man in a private, not-for-profit hospital in another city. And he was being told by his boss, who was over accounting at the hospital, that he had to do something in a certain way. And it certainly did not fit the social work way of doing things. It fit the money way of doing things. He had been going to this man who was an accountant. I have nothing against accountants. I have a very good one myself. And telling him why it was just not right to do it that way. He had pretty quickly been labeled the bleeding heart liberal social worker who didn't understand the financial realities of his work setting. I said, go get your licensing code and show him the article in the code of conduct that says you can't do it this way. And remind him that if you do, you may be found to be practicing unethically. And if something happens to the patient, it may be a matter of lawsuit. He suddenly was talking the language that his boss understood because it had dollar signs. He was no longer the bleeding heart liberal. He was no longer just protecting the patient. He was now protecting the institution. So that outside controlling professional suddenly realized that maybe this was the way this should be done. Codes provide standards for public accountability. If, for example, you do something that's considered unethical, somebody wants to bring civil charges against you, somebody wants to bring licensing charges against you, their attorney is going to look at your code to say you have violated public accountability. This is interesting from the standpoint of if you're in a state court, they can easily look at the state licensing code. If you're not in a state court, if you're in a federal court, they most usually look at the code of the national professional organization that represents your profession, because that gives them a notion of what the profession holds you publicly accountable for. Codes also articulate standards for performance and protect professionals against litigation. if you are acting within your code, if you are acting the way any reasonable and prudent person would act, you have a great deal more protection than normal. I wonder how many of you are told by your state licensing board that you must put your code of ethics up on the wall in your office so that public can see it, and that if the public feels you violated this, they are told how they can get in touch with your licensing board. I had a very funny comment in a presentation several years ago from a young woman who did home health social work in rural East Texas. Rural East Texas is a country all unto itself, if none of you've ever been there, but it's part of the state. And her office literally was her very large pickup truck. That's where she carried everything. And somebody in the class laughingly said to her, "Well, where do you put your code of ethics if that's your office? You know, you're supposed to have it up." She laughed and said, "It's easy. It's behind the passenger side sun visor. They just have to flip it down. It's right there in front of them." They thought that was pretty funny. I think that's probably a little over the top, but it gives you an idea. I'm sure this woman was a fabulous practitioner because she thought very quickly on her feet. For some of you that live in rural areas, you probably understand that this is your office. Your car or your truck is your office. Codes are developed by three different organizational entities. First, professional organizations all have a code of ethics. That's one of the hallmarks of a professional organization. I am surprised when students and young professionals tell me what professional organization they belong to, and I ask the very simple question of, "Have you read the code of ethics?" They look at me strangely and say, "No, I just sent in my money and they just sent me stuff. And I think maybe somebody said something about it in school, but no, I haven't read it." And I say to them that they are probably putting themselves in jeopardy, because if you belong to that organization, you have signed up to abide by the code of ethics. In social work, everybody says, "Oh yeah, I belong to NASW. It's like, well, do you belong to any other professional organization? And if you do, which organizational code do you look at? There are some that think that NASW is the only organization within social work. It's not. There's a National Association of Catholic Social Workers. There's an Association of Black Social Workers. There are many, many, many professional organizations for us. Somebody said in a presentation recently, "Is it just social workers that has all those different organizations? I mean, I'm a psychologist and I don't think that we have a national association of this, that, or the other. I think it's all the APA." And I said, "Well, social work's a big tent and we believe in being inclusive. So we have a lot of different organizations within the profession." What happens to you if you violate a professional organization code of ethics? The professional organizations have ethics committees, or committees on inquiry, or whatever they choose to call them, that people can complain and say, "Okay, they're a member of this organization, but they violated the code." The Committee on Inquiry looks through the code, finds the article that people think you have violated, and investigates it, and then determines whether or not you have in fact done this. If they determine that you violated the code, they can sanction you in some way. Can they stop you from practicing? No. They can throw you out of the organization. They can embarrass you publicly by publishing your name in their national or state or whatever newsletter. but they can't stop you from practicing. And most of your clients don't read your professional organization newsletter to see whether or not your name is in it. Most clients don't think of calling a national professional organization to inquire about whether or not you're in good standing. And interestingly enough, several years ago, I was sitting on NASW, Texas Committee on Inquiry, and we got a letter from National saying that a person from Texas had been listed in NASW's news for maybe 15 years for an ethics violation. And that seemed like a long time to them. And could we look at it and see whether or not his name still needed to be there? Those of us around the table all knew this name. And the letter that went back to NASW said, well, you probably can take it out because for most of the time that he's been listed as violating professional ethics in relation to sexual conduct, he's been dead. So he came out of the booklet very quickly after that. But professional organizations can sanction their members by terminating their membership. Now, some professional organizations, some state chapters of some professional organizations, if you are found in violation of a professional code of ethics, will then make a complaint to your licensing board. That doesn't happen everywhere. It is at the discretion of the organization. But for some people, this is what happens. So violating that professional organization code may be the first step in licensure action. State licensing boards also develop either a code of ethics or a code of conduct for professionals that are licensed. And violation of a state licensing board can result in sanctions up to and including removal of your license, which means that you could no longer practice legally in that state. There are a number of sanctions that do not involve this, everything from suspending your license for a short period of time to putting you under long periods of supervision around your ethical violation. But ultimately, a licensing board can remove your right to practice in that as a professional in that state. That does bad things to you, like say you can't bill insurance companies. Licensing boards do not like to accept a surrender of a license if someone is guilty and comes to the board and says, I did it, here, you can have it, I don't want this license anymore. The reason they don't like to accept a surrender is then they lose complete control of you. They cannot sanction you. And if you're filling out a form about malpractice insurance, about trying to get a license in another state, there's no record of a licensure violation. So you can really check the box that says action has never been taken by a licensing board. That's kind of a scary thing. What about those of us, not those of us, I don't. I gave away my other license when I became the chair of the social work board and realized how much trouble I could get myself in with one license, much less two. How many of us have multiple licenses? We may be a licensed social worker. We may be a licensed marriage and family therapist. That provides a little bit of drama sometimes. If you have multiple licenses, you are answerable to multiple licensing boards unless you do something so egregious that the boards get together and make a decision about sanction and both boards do the same thing. Another question if you have multiple licenses is, which one are you obligated to if there are differences? For example, Some licenses say no sex with a client or former client ever. Other licenses say no sex with a client or former client for 3 to 5 years after the end of the professional relationship, if an unencumbered third party determines that it would not be exploitive of the patient. What do? You have an interesting situation. Mr. or Ms. Gorgeous comes into your office. You're a licensed marriage and family therapist. You're a licensed social worker. And you think, wow, look at this person. They're very attractive. I could be very attracted to them. Do you go up and turn your most restrictive license to the wall and say, okay, today, instead of a social worker, I'm going to treat you as a licensed marriage and family therapist or as a licensed professional counselor? I wish it were that easy. It's not. If you hold multiple state licenses and there are ethics questions, you are held to the highest standard of the license that you, whichever license you hold. If the social workers say you can never do something, the LPCs say you can do it in 3 years, you have to be held to the never standard. The other place where codes are developed is by agencies and institutions. More and more agencies are developing their own code of ethics that regulates the practice of the people that work there. If that is the case, you may need to be aware of this before you take a job in an agency. What if they are asking you to do things that don't fit with either of the codes we've already talked about? That could prove problematic to you. And if your ethical principles don't really agree with that code, is this a place you should practice? I had a very interesting situation several years ago when I was doing clinical supervision for advanced licensure of a young social worker who worked for an agency in Texas. If you get outside supervision, the licensing board requires that you have a letter from the agency that goes to the licensing board that says that agency knows you're getting outside supervision and approves that outside supervision. This young woman came to me with a letter. She worked in a group psychiatric practice. There was a psychiatrist, there were a number of clinical psychologists, and there were a number of social workers. She came to me with a perfectly good letter from the psychiatrist that ran the practice, owned the practice, that said she could get clinical supervision from me. That was fine. Several weeks later, she came to supervision with a letter that the psychiatrist had given her and told her she had to give to all of her clients. And the letter stated that he was no longer responsible, nor was his practice any longer responsible for her work. That if she did anything unethical, I was responsible. Not him, not the practice. Needless to say, I was just a little bit unnerved by that. So I called him. And the first 30 seconds of the conversation were rather cordial. The rest of it was not. I said to him, I don't think you understand. She works for you. You cannot abdicate responsibility. I now share responsibility for her work because I am her clinical supervisor. But you can't give it away. He no longer was very nice. I heard words that I generally don't hear from other professionals because he said that he absolutely would not abide by that and that I was wrong. Well, it became very clear to me very quickly that talking sense was not going to work here. So I thanked him, hung up, called the young woman. I have a clause in my contract with supervisees that says that this supervisory relationship can be terminated with 2 weeks written notice by either party. I asked her to come to my office. I gave her a letter saying that effective in 2 weeks, I was no longer her clinical supervisor. But I had to be very careful. Her agency didn't have a written code of ethics, but it certainly had a practice code of ethics that I didn't agree with. But she was a very ethical young practitioner. So I said to her, I really have great concerns about your safety, your professional safety, working in an agency like this. And I would ask you to think very hard about whether or not this was the place you needed to be. I told her I would be more than happy to continue her supervision in the future if she worked somewhere else, but that I really could not put my license on the line for work in an agency I did not agree with the ethics. She heard everything I said. She understood that I was not criticizing her in any way. And she eventually quit, went to work for another agency that was much more ethical, and where they provided supervision, fortunately, and she no longer had to pay for it. But it taught me a very important lesson. If I am going to provide clinical supervision in a setting, I need to know something about the ethics of that setting. I know the agencies where I live very, very well, but if I don't know something about a new agency, I do some research before I take on anyone from that agency for clinical supervision, because my license is on the line at this point also. One of the things about codes of ethics is they cannot be so abstract as to defy interpretation and application. This is not going to help you at all if you're trying to use a code to solve an ethical dilemma. It can't be written in lawyer speak, because we don't understand that very well. It needs to be written in words that we understand. After having been in a situation of helping to enforce a state licensing code of conduct, worry about states that the code of ethics in the license is very abstract and leaves a lot to individual interpretation. They need to be general enough to meaningful apply to a variety of patients, clients, situations, and circumstances. This is the way we have our best opportunity to use our codes of ethics when we have an ethical question. Code principles are not of the same order. Most professional organization codes are what they call aspirational. This says, wouldn't it be nice if? These are, again, mostly found in professional organizations. Again, some state licensing boards have adopted NASW's code of ethics as their code of conduct for the license. If I were the chair of that board, or if I were the attorney representing that board, I would have a lot of trouble with that, because a number of the principles in NASW's code, a number of the tenets in the code, are aspirational. Codes are supposed to represent norms of the profession. And we have to wonder if norms change over time. When I became the chair of the Texas Licensing Board, I received a very official-looking letter from the state attorney general's office saying that as an elected or appointed official, that was scary enough to begin with, I had to attend ethics training done by the attorney general's office. I thought, oh dear, 2 days of lawyers, I'm never going to survive. But down at the bottom it said that I would be fined $100 a day for every day that I didn't show up. Austin's not very far from Houston. It doesn't take but about 2.5 hours to get there. So I made the decision that I would go, and I would go very quickly. When I got there, all prepared to be very, very, very bored, I found out that the first day of the training was to be done by Barbara Jordan, and the second day of the training was to be done by Governor Ann Richards. I'm dating myself, I know, but I was sure I had died and gone to heaven. I have never learned so much in 2 days in my entire life. And one of the things that I can still hear her voice in my head is Barbara Jordan talking about norms and how politicians, and I really didn't like being put in that category, but I suddenly was, don't get in trouble for violating ethical principles because they know what those principles are. There's not a question in their head about the principles. They get in trouble for misreading what the environment will accept. Something some politician may have been able to get away with years and years ago before we knew instantly every breath they took, they could not get away with now. So she said that we would probably not get in trouble for not knowing ethical principles because we knew those. We would get in trouble for misreading the ethical environment and doing things that the current environment would not represent as acceptable. Norms change over time. Principles don't. So if you read your code of ethics 20 years ago, you may need to reread it because things may have changed in it because of changes in the time. Example, right now, one of the biggest ethical challenges that licensing boards are facing is technology. We didn't have those kind of things. We didn't have those kind of problems 15 years ago. We now have them everywhere. I just went to a very, very helpful Grand Rounds around changes in the environment because of technology. A wonderful example was given about should professionals join Twitter, join Facebook, join whatever. And a young psychiatric resident had a bachelor party. And he had kind of overindulged in the spirits at the bachelor party, and somebody took a lot of pictures. He didn't have a Facebook account or a Twitter account because he was aware of the possible pitfalls. One of his friends, who was not a mental health professional, posted all of the pictures online. And you know, we all know at some point in treatment, our clients may be very curious about us. So he had a couple of clients that searched Facebook on a regular basis to see if there was anything about him. And they found the pictures. And it caused all kinds of problems with his practice with these patients, because they had seen him in a way they did not want to see the person that was treating them. Actually, most of them were substance dependence patients, which made it even worse. But codes represent norms, and as norms change, codes change. NASW changed their code in the mid-90s because it didn't represent the times. Some principles of codes are prescriptive and imperative, and start with words like must, which means that they can't be changed. It would be nice if it is, this is the way it must be done, or this is the way it must not be done. So you need to keep these things in mind if you are looking at codes to help you solve ethical dilemmas. Let's cut for a minute. So we've done an hour and we need another. Woo!